Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, March 28th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll get an update on the Juno Community Band with Todd Hunt and Sarah McNair-Grove. We'll hear about this Friday's ACLU Citizen Activist Workshop. Beth Weigel and Colette Costa will preview their Science on Screen event, and we'll check in with the Juno School District. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here, live and local, on a Juno afternoon. Currently 43 degrees at the Juno International Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The leader of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe says he's undeterred by news that oil has been placed in the Dakota Access Pipeline underneath Lake Oahe in North Dakota. Dakota Access provided the update in documents filed in federal court Monday. Cheyenne River Sioux Chairman Harold Frazier says the fact that oil is flowing under the water is a blow, but says the legal fight is alive. The tribe, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and other members of the Great Sioux Nation are challenging the legality of the project, which includes allegations of treaty violations. They have a pair of motions pending in federal court. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe also says the pipeline threatens tribal religious freedom. That claim is pending in an appeals court as Dakota Access prepares to place the pipeline into service. Family members of L'Oreal Sinigini, along with advocates, remembered her life Monday on the anniversary of her death in Winslow, Arizona. The Navajo woman was shot 5 times by a Winslow police officer last year during an altercation, which escalated from a shoplifting call. The officer, who faced no charges, said Sinigini threatened him with a pair of scissors. No evidence of criminal conduct on the part of Austin Shipley was found, and he resigned months after the shooting. Sinigini's family, along with advocates, marched from City Hall to the police station where they held a vigil. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe in New York is petitioning to make more land part of its reservation. As North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports, the land into trust application deals with part of the historic Mohawk land claim.
A federal judge has ruled the St. Regis Mohawks may have a legitimate claim to a slice of land contiguous to the tribe's reservation. The tribe argues European settlers bought the tract in violation of a federal treaty in the early 1800s. The tribe has negotiated a partial settlement to reacquire the land, but a neighboring county is holding out. Chief Beverly Cook says the tribe is growing and needs the land that's part of its historic territory.
We have business that we have to conduct for our community, and expanding the land base is one. Developing goals and strategies that we have that further economic development.
So the Mohawks have submitted land into trust applications for 220 acres of the land. The federal government already approved a 40-acre plot to become part of the Akwesasne Mohawk Reservation in 2015. Neighboring Franklin County officials say the issue is complicated and will take time to resolve. Mohawk chiefs say they'd still prefer a settlement. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein in Canton, New York.
In Canada, a politician is under pressure to step down after comments she made about Indian residential schools. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, she said there were positive aspects to the school system.
Lynn Bayak is a member of the Senate Committee on Aboriginal People, and it was her comment about residential schools last month in the upper chamber of the Canadian Parliament that got her into hot water.
Obviously, the negative issues must be addressed, but it is unfortunate that they are sometimes magnified and considered more newsworthy than the abundance of good.
That was her way of saying that the government-financed, church-run schools where Indigenous children endured widespread sexual and physical abuse were not all bad. It drew a storm of criticism from the opposition as well as from within her own party. Many have called for Bayak's resignation. Georgina Jolibois is a member of Parliament for the New Democratic Party.
Residential schools were profoundly damaging to First Nations and remain a dark chapter in Canada's history. Children were forcibly taken from their families and homes for the exact purpose of trying to wipe out their languages and their identities.
The Minister of Indigenous and Northern Affairs, Carolyn Bennett, was quick to agree.
Comments like these are ill-informed, offensive, and simply wrong.
But Senator Bayak is standing her ground, and by her comments, she says one can never excuse or minimize the suffering that residential school victims experienced. That hasn't stopped the firestorm of criticism against her.
That was Dan Karpinchuk. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by the Fred Jones Jr. Museum of Art at the University of Oklahoma. Photosynthesis. New photographs by Navajo Will Wilson, plus early works by Edward Curtis. Photosynthesis through April 2nd. Info at fjjma.ou.edu.
Support by Bears Ears National Monument, created to honor tribes and protect traditional access. You can tell President Trump to honor tribes and protect Bears Ears at protectbearsears.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, March 28th. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. And in the studio now are members of the Juno Community Band, President of the Board, Sarah McNairgrove, and also Artistic Director Todd Hunt. Welcome to the show, you two.
Hey, thank you.
Sarah, let's start with you. The Juno Community Band, when did it form?
Well, the band formed probably about 8 to 10 years ago, but it was formed because adult players of wind and brass instruments like trumpets and tubas and clarinets were looking for some place to play, and the only available option prior to that was the volunteer marching band that gets together once a year for the 4th of July parade. And we thought, well, we'd like to do something a little bit more. So over the years, it's been discussed. About 8 to 10 years ago, we said, let's do it. So we formed the Juno Community Bands to provide another outlet for adult players to play.
And you're telling me there's about 30 members.
We have about 30 members, right. And from all walks of life, we even have a couple of very talented high school players that play with us as well. And we're always looking for people. If you play something, we'd love to hear from you.
And you play clarinet, right?
I play clarinet. Mm-hmm.
Todd, tell us about some of the other instruments in the band.
Oh, sure. So we could cover like woodwinds and brass, so that's like flutes and clarinets. The brass being like trumpets and tubas and trombones, whatnot. But also percussion, so which is wildly numerous. So timpani and, you know, things you hit and beat on and drop and shake and that kind of thing. Something, you know, a holdover from, I don't know, a long time ago is a string bass. Yeah, so there is one lone string player in our group, too.
It sounds very eclectic.
Yeah, it is kind of eclectic, but that's how you get such a rich variety of color.
I bet. Yeah. So you have a concert this Saturday, right, mm-hmm. at the Jack, the Juno Arts and Culture Center, across the street from K2 here. 7:30?
7:30. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, that's going to be fun. What do you like most about participating in the Juno Community Band,
Well,
Sarah?
Well, it's fun just to play, to get to know people, and I think this concert that we have coming up, we picked the date April 1st because that looked like it was a good date for everybody, and then we realized what day that was. April Fools, we said, take advantage of April Fools. So we have lots of pieces that have kind of what we're calling musical jokes in them, ways that composers kind of have fun with pieces that they compose. Mm-hmm. So that's been a lot of fun to put that on, and Todd can tell you about what some of those are.
Yeah, sure. So I guess in some ways the centerpiece of the program is a work by P.D.Q. Bach, and if you're familiar with this wonderful composer, he's actually just the brainchild of a musical comedian named Peter Schickele, who writes this completely silly music and then puts, you know, the name of the supposed, you know, illegitimate son of Bach, J.S. Bach, that we all know and love. So that's the Grand Serenade for an Awful Lot of Winds and Percussion is the name of that. And it's just as silly as the name sounds. It's also got lots of other pieces, and this is actually a really different concert for me because there's, I don't even know how many, probably 12 or 15 pieces we're doing on the program. So all of them are like 3 to 5 minutes long, you know, very approximately. So there's tons of things, and, you know, we can't possibly get into all the details. But there is a lot of silliness. There's some serious things just to, like, give a break. So a couple things that aren't jokes at all. And one piece on the program is actually an homage to Sergei Rachmaninoff, whose birthday is April 1st. So, again, it's not a joke, but we'll have Brian Van Kirk, who is going to play Rachmaninoff's vocalese on soprano saxophone with us, so with the wind ensemble accompanying.
And are you going to be playing or conducting?
I'll be conducting.
Tell us what we should look for as you conduct. What are some of the things you're communicating with the band?
Oh, my gosh. I guess the first thing that I would try to communicate is tempo, is to try to keep everything together, start things on time, you know, cutoffs. And beyond that, you know, assuming all that stuff is working just fine, then it would be a little bit more expression, balance, you know, trying to get, you know, some instruments to play louder, some to play softer, so that the whole comes out correctly.
Somebody makes a really bad choice. Do you have something you do with your hands or your face?
Yeah, so I have this my patented napalm. So I put my palm up to right to their face. And I call that
you
my
get
napalm.
The evil yeah. eye from the conductor. Huh?
It's like, you just stop now.
Sarah, you said that you started or were part of the, you know, Juno Community Band's formation because you wanted more opportunities to play in Juno. So you'll be playing this Saturday at the Jack. When else can we see you?
We traditionally have two concerts a year, one in the fall and one in the spring. So this is our spring concert. This year we're also doing something kind of fun. We are having a Pops concert just before the 4th of July. So and Dwayne Corbin will be a guest conductor coming up for that, so we'll have a lot of patriotic kinds of things. So watch for that. We'll talk about that. So this year we're actually having three concerts.
Okay. Well, this sounds like a lot of fun. It's this Saturday at the Jack at 7:30. If people want more information, where should they go?
They can go to the Juno Community Band's Facebook page, and there's information on there. We also have email, which is junocommunityband@gmail.com.
And how much are tickets?
Tickets are $15 for adults, $5 for students, and you can get them at the normal places, the Jack and Hearthside Books and online. And come prepared to laugh. It's going to be an awful lot of fun. This is a concert that you don't have to sit and be serious at.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
A lot of silliness, probably.
Great.
Antics going on, I think.
Anything else either of you'd like to add?
No, just come to the concert. We'll look forward to seeing you on Saturday.
All right, well, forgive me. I couldn't get my hands on any recordings of the Juno Community Band, but I have been wanting to play the Murphy Beds, which is our guest artist for the Alaska Folk Fest next week. So, anyway, here are the Murphy Beds.
Spend one night with my only lass. If the night were dark as a dungeon, and not a star ever to appear, I would be guided without a stumble to that sweet island where lies my dear. When I came to my true love's window, I kneeled low on a outside my window. she says, my love, the cocks are crowing. It's now full time you are going away.
KTOO's spring membership campaign is underway. Some of you may be thinking, uh-oh, the fundraiser. We hear you, which is why we're dedicated to giving back the airwaves and keeping messages short. Believe it or not, this is the fundraiser, this short message. Thank you to our sustaining members who are always up to date and to those of you who have already contributed this spring. If you have not yet made a contribution, you can do so at ktoo.org. Support comes from Travel Juno, presenting the 2017 Travel Fair at the Jack, April 15th from 12 to 4 p.m., featuring local tourism businesses, food trucks, live music, and more. Info at junotravelfair.com.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, March 28th. It's about 17 minutes past the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and Shelley Delaney, KTOO Operations Manager today, is engineering. Our next guest is Trish Turner Custard, and she's a member of the ACLU. And welcome to the show, Trish.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So I understand you're going to have a workshop this Friday night at Northern Light United Church. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. The ACLU of Alaska, the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska, is going to be coming down to present a citizen activist training from 6:30 to 8 o'clock on Friday, March 31st, Northern Light United Church. I always want to put the S on that, lights. The program will include the ACLU of Alaska's overview and priorities, legislative monitoring in the Capitol, kind of a Know Your Rights primer, and how to be an effective citizen activist.
Okay. Citizen activist. Yes. What is a citizen activist?
Activist is often kind of a scary word for people. They get a little bit, their hackles get up when they hear that word. But really, an activist is no more than an engaged citizen. We have to remember that our responsibility does not end at the voting booth. It just begins there. And to protect our democracy, we need to be engaged. We need to be active.
Okay. When did you become a member of the ACLU, if I may ask?
Boy, I've been a member for decades now, and I'm also a member of Congregation Sukkot Shalom, who are the organizers and the initiators of this program. And last fall, I decided to take an online course in constitutional law, and I kind of fell in love with the Constitution again. It was an offshoot of my love for the musical Hamilton. Then I fell in love again with the Constitution, knowing that I had learned all this at one time in my life, many moons ago in high school. So I took the constitutional law class and thought, how can we do something with this? Well, I thought, I'm a member of the ACLU. I'm a member of the congregation. We do a lot of social action work there. So let's pull these all together and see if the ACLU will come down from Anchorage and give us a little primer on the Constitution and on our rights.
Okay. You've sort of outlined it a little bit, but tell us more about what people could expect if they go on Friday night.
Well, we're hoping really what will happen is that they'll get to know a little bit more about what the ACLU does, who they are, a little bit more about them, because it's an organization that people hear the acronym, but they're not quite sure what it's about. And the ACLU was founded in 1920 as a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. They take no sides. They are totally nonpartisan. The only side they take is for the Constitution. And they were established to fight for the freedom of speech. And since then, they've branched out to cover all our rights according to us, to the Constitution. So we'll learn about that. We'll learn about what our rights are and how we can actually use those rights. If we see something that's happening that we don't like, what do we do about that? How do we speak effectively to that?
And before the show, you were telling me that workshops like this, it's kind of a new thing for the ACLU, right?
It is. The ACLU has usually been, we know of them being in the courtroom. But with recent events and with people getting more engaged in their democracy, they have decided to take their battle out of the courtroom onto the streets using volunteers, everyday people, in grassroots efforts. So this will be one of these type of things that we're doing here to help to train people to do that.
Excellent. Can you give us one example of a technique you might share on Friday night?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I'll have to say no to that.
All right.
Sorry to
it's
say.
Okay, our listeners.
You stumped me.
Well, our listeners will have to attend.
Yes, it'll be a mystery. I was doing so well, Scott. Boy.
Well, it's interesting that the League of Women Voters has their sort of workshop, I guess
yes.
it is, on Saturday morning up at the Capitol School. And that's on effective lobbying.
Lobbying, yes.
You seem like perfectly timed. On Friday night, we can go
right.
to yours, and on Saturday morning, we can go to theirs.
And actually, I can think of something that they'll tell us about. A lot of things, we've seen a lot of marches happening across country, a lot of people standing outside courtrooms or outside Capitol buildings. And we need to know exactly what are our rights when we do that. How can we effectively demonstrate, protest, just have our voices heard, and what exactly can we do and what can't we do? And we have all kinds of rights, according to us, under the Constitution, to be there, to speak our minds, and to really engage with our democracy.
Okay. So that is this Friday night at Northern Light United Church, 6:30 to 8.
8. It's free of charge. Afterwards, we'll have a social. And I'd like to just put a plug out for our partners in this event, the Juno People for Peace and Justice, Northern Light United Church, and the Juno Unitarian Universalist Fellowship have all stepped up to help support us in this.
I think I know how you're going to answer this, but who would benefit from going to your workshop on Friday?
Everyone. Across the political spectrum, whatever side you're on, please, I really, if you can have one takeaway from this, please know that the ACLU is nonpartisan. They are just protecting all of our rights.
All right. You've been listening to Trish Turner Custard. She's a member of the ACLU here in Juneau, and she is going to be taking part in a workshop this Friday night from 6:30 to 8 at the Northern Light United Church. Trish, if somebody wants more information, is there a Facebook page they can go to or a
website?
Actually,
they can just email me at sawginfo@gmail.com.
SAWGinfo?
Yes.
@gmail.com?
Mm-hmm. That's the Social Action Working Group of the Congregation Sukkot Shalom.
Great. Trish, thanks for coming on the show. Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for KTOO is provided by Davies Berry Insurance, serving southeastern Alaska since 1917 with personal and commercial insurance, including bonds, marine, auto, and more. 789-5900.
Well, I'm Clay Good. I'm remembering the community as a former science teacher and a longtime musician around town. Been playing in various bands around here for about 40 years or so. I was a new teacher in the district, probably my first or second year, and this assistant principal asked me if I was a member of K2. And I said, well, no. And he says, well, you listen to it, don't you? I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you know what to do. There's a lot of young folks out there who are like 25 years old, like I was when my vice principal encouraged me to join, who may not be members, but who, along with me, are looking for good news and quality information. And it's a good time to invest in quality media. And the sooner the better. You know what to do.
Please take a moment to begin, renew, or upgrade your membership now at ktoo.org. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, March 28th. I have a great crew in the studio now. They're here as part of the Science on Screen event. Colette Costa, the Queen of the Nickelodeon, Beth Weigel, the Queen of the Library, and also Michelle Ridgway, Queen of the Submarine, or the Queen of the Deep, something like that. Scientist. She's an Alaska Marine ecologist and submersible pilot. Welcome to the show, you three.
You went with that idea.
I did.
Very brave.
Yep. Thank you.
You went deep with it.
I did.
You're unfathomable.
All right, so Science on Screen, there's a movie tonight, 7 p.m. at the Goldtown Nick. But before that, it starts with a lecture by Michelle at the library. Did this start with the theater or with you at the library? How'd this come together, Beth?
Well, like all great ideas, it was sort of born out of Costa's head. But no, it's a total collaboration. So she came to me and said, hey, there's this grant that I'm interested in, but we're a for-profit and we need a nonprofit partner. And I said, hey, maybe we can do that through the Friends of the Library. Let me see how that works out. And so we wrote the grant 2 years ago and received it last year and this year as well. So it's sort of a collaboration between the Friends of the Juneau Public Libraries, the Juneau Public Libraries, and the Goldtown Nickelodeon. So we're excited to get this a second year in a row. And tonight's particularly special because it is the National Evening of Science on Screen, which means that there's like 33 theaters across the nation holding a Science on Screen program and screening tonight. Not necessarily what we're doing, but all those independent theaters are doing something.
Very cool. And so the model works, right? At 5:30, Michelle, you will give a lecture at the downtown library.
Okay. Yep, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then everyone just walks, what is that, you know, a couple hundred yards over to the Goldtown Nick for the movie
yep.
at 7?
And you can't miss it tonight because there's a huge yellow submarine parked out in front of the Goldtown.
The real deal. Like this
the
is
real
not
deal.
This is one that you've been in, right? This is your machine.
This is a working submarine. It's retired at the moment and serves primarily as a teaching prop. It's excellent for teaching students principles of submarine mission planning and anatomy and physiology of a submersible, understanding the basic systems on a sub, conning towers, thruster systems, battery systems and such.
Wow. Will you tell us about maybe one of your most memorable missions?
Oh, one of my most memorable missions probably in Zemchug Canyon, which is located near the Russian border in the Bering Sea. It's a subarctic site. It is the largest undersea canyon in the world. And when we arrived, we traveled nearly 2 days both north and then far, far west. Water was beautifully clear, and we are in a region of the world that has been rarely traveled and not charted. So we're about to dive down to about 600 meters in uncharted waters. And it was a beautiful day, a bit of fog, as is common in the Bering Sea. And I went through the 2.5 hours of prep for the sub, entered the water, was released from the boat. We dive untethered. And as I began to submerge, I looked around and saw these creatures darting around me, and they circled closer and closer, and I was found myself surrounded by a pod of Ball's porpoise. They're an oceanic. They look like a miniature killer whale. And this pod was so curious. They were rolling their eyes and looking me eyeball to eyeball through the acrylic dome. And talk about putting you at ease. Being escorted into the deep ocean by a pod of creatures who are quite at home. They've evolved for over 35 million years there. And they basically took me down. They continued to go back to the surface and get a breath and target right straight back to me.
Crazy.
And they stayed with me for quite a while as I descended on that particular dive.
What's it like at, say, 600 meters?
Oh, it can be quite variable depending upon the environment you're in. In Alaska, it's typically dark, of course, because the incidence of sun angle at our latitudes is quite low, so it penetrates the seawater very little at that depth. We have halogen and LED light systems and such, but we have a tremendous abundance of life here. As everyone knows, that region is very abundant in fish, and mammals and birds migrate to the area. And so from the water surface to the very bottom, it's loaded with life, microfauna and macrofauna. So there's, at depth, a lot of squid, a lot of very exotic-appearing crustaceans and echinoderms related to the sea stars, for example, but highly adapted to life under pressure and under a very different light attenuation regime than we're accustomed to. So we have life forms that are brilliant orange and pink, and they're adapted for life at depth with tiny eyes. They don't see their prey. They're not visual. So you see creatures that are somewhat familiar looking to what you see at sea level, but again, adapted for the vagaries of life at depth.
Wow, great description.
That's what she does. That's why we've got her on board tonight, man.
Like fancy science words there.
That's the whole idea behind our Science on Screen program, is that we pair a scientist to talk about these sorts of scientific principles with a really awesome film.
That's what we do, Scott Burton! Have you not been listening all this time?
The Abyss, Colette. How did you choose this film?
Well, it reminded me of my prom night. Just got getting deeper and deeper and deeper and colder and more pressure. And I love this movie. Well, so sometimes we pick a movie and then we find a scientist. Sometimes we have a scientist in mind and we pick a movie. And this year we are focusing on women in science. And we have a natural lead-in with Ms. Ridgway here, who I've known for simply ages. And I think what she does is just crazy fascinating, even though I don't understand 70% of the words she uses. But I make them up in my head what she's talking about. And it was just such a natural fit. And I actually want to do something a little less... direct, you know. We talked about doing that crazy Tony Randall movie, which I loved. But The Abyss is just such a neoclassic, and
I'd never seen it, so she said,
"What?" That's what I said.
Yeah.
And we have it on 35 millimeter, which is a whole other thing that I'm super excited about. It's a James Cameron movie, so he kind of knocked it out of the park with, like, he went Terminator, Aliens, The Abyss, and it was like boom, boom, boom. And so this was part of his, what I consider his trifecta of greatness. It's a 1989 movie, Ed Harris, who's stellar in everything, great backup cast, and he did, you know, as he is...
Great Submarines.
Oh, Great Submarines. And Michelle's actually, she brought in this awesome thing that is just like the one they use in the movies to make them go around, this thrusting machine.
Remotely operated vehicles, ROVs.
Yes, ROV. They're called ROVs, and they have tethers, which is a plot point in the movie. I can tell you what, but it's super exciting. Mm. The movie itself doesn't matter. What is it about? It's about awesome stuff that happens underwater.
And aliens.
A civilian team goes to help out a nuclear sub that's trapped, and then just craziness ensues. It's a fantastic, fantastic film. And I just watched a little making of, and he built at the time was the largest underwater set ever. And they used an old nuclear power plant that had been emptied out, and it took them 4 or 5 days to fill it with water. It's a really interesting making of. That's on YouTube. I found it. That's okay. What we do, 7 o'clock.
What age group is this good for?
10.
Well, the movie is rated R.
It's rated R if you get concerned about that stuff. It's rated R because they swear a lot, and there's a quick shot of boobs, and that's it. Really, it's swearing. It's very action-packed. There is some psychological
suspense.
You know, I wouldn't say under 12, although considering what the kids watch these days, you know. It's
an awesome film if you're interested in submarine technology. Cameron spared no expense in getting the best of the best. For the day, submersibles and ROV technology. So,
and he was inventing, like, at the time, cutting edge CGI, computer graphic, imagery that kind of didn't exist at the time. And when you saw that movie in 1989, you were just blown away at what he had developed to make it.
And he also, when you get into the abyss and you see this fantastical world that he created in his mind and with this amazing set. He actually was using some cutting-edge science as well for what we were beginning to learn at that time in the late 80s about the deep sea. He definitely delves into bioluminescence. He also begins to introduce in caricature but some forms that actually are very reminiscent of some spectacular gelatinous zooplankton, organisms that live in the open ocean at great depth. That we had just been learning about, and he sort of weaves in some of these character forms and behaviors into his film.
Like the actual real deep sea creatures that are neon and light up. They really like party. They're having a rave so deep in the ocean that people are not allowed to go to. It's like the most. It's like Vegas down there, but only for like the super elite with no bones.
Michelle. Michelle, thinking about your talk at 5:30, what are you going to focus on?
Well, I will provide first just a brief primer about the deep ocean, you know, some of the basics for students that may be in the audience, young and older students as well, just sort of thinking about this amazing single ocean that we all share that dominates our planet. We're the blue planet, and so I'll be speaking a bit about the deep ocean, about some of the physical features that creatures that occupy the deep ocean need to adapt to. And we humans are not highly adapted for the deep ocean, so I'll get into some of the engineering and physics that we need to use for developing tools to be able to access the deep sea.
Oh, it sounds really interesting.
I'll probably touch on a few deep sea recent observations and discoveries. Just touch on a few and then talk about Cameron's film briefly.
Okay, and that's about 5:30 to 6:30?
Yeah, we'll start at 5:30, and we expect her to talk for about 40 minutes and have some time for some questions and then time for people to make their way over to the Gold Town with the beacon of the yellow submarine out in front. And again, the film screening tonight is free as part of this grant that we received from the Coolidge Corner Theater, which is also funded by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. So we're super excited about our program tonight, and we hope that people will come out.
This is Science on Screen tonight, 5:30, starting at the library with the film at 7 at the Gold Town Theater. And then did I see there's another repeat of this on Friday?
There is. So I'm having two extra screenings that are not part of the Science on Screen. It's just when I have a 35-millimeter movie in, I like to get multiple screenings. They are not free, but if you can't make it tonight, you can go tomorrow at 7 p.m. or Friday at 9 p.m. And if you haven't seen this movie, for goodness sakes, people... One thing I do want to say that it might get rather crowded tonight. I'm holding seats and giving priority seating to people who are at the lecture so that they don't feel like they have to leave the lecture early to get a seat. So I'll be holding seats for anyone who goes to the lecture. Ring-a-ding-dang, how do you like them apples?
All right.
And just to make sure everybody understands, Michelle won't be talking at the other two screenings that
correct
either. So she'll just be right. Talking tonight.
5:30, Downtown Library. Admission is free. And
get in
free
there.
To the movie, 7 o'clock.
Deep.
Are we missing anything?
We're just missing the people out there listening to come to the library and to the screening tonight.
I know. I am missing my purse. It was stolen yesterday. If you see it, little red thing, orange wallet inside. Need my Costco card back. Thanks.
Thank you all so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Scott Burton.
Thanks, Scott Burton. Thanks,
Scott.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention? Thank you.
PTOO Spring Fundraiser is underway, and this year we're dedicated to giving back the airwaves. What does that mean? It means we're trying to keep these messages short to avoid any interruptions to our regular shows. Give now and help KTOO reach its goal of $160,000 before June 30th. Go to ktoo.org or pop a check in the mail to make your contribution today.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, March 28th, 2017. It's about 10 minutes until the top of the hour. And our last guests on the show today are Brenda Taylor and Lindsay Holbert. And they are part of the Juno STEM Coalition. They both happen to be teachers as well at the charter school. And today we're going to be talking about the Juno STEM Coalition and what it does in the school district, in the community. Welcome to the show, Brenda and Lindsay.
Thank you.
Nice to have you both. Brenda, we got to talk to you a couple weeks ago, a little bit about the Juno STEM Coalition, but remind us what it is.
So it's a group of people, teachers, administrators, and then community members who would like to figure out how to have more STEM experiences for kids in the school day and then also outside of the school day as well. And how do we match the resources that we have in our wonderful community with the needs of the teachers and the kids? And STEM stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Before the show, you told me a great example of how this worked just the other day.
So there was a fourth grade teacher at Glacier Valley, and she knows that we are developing a database of community members who have STEM expertise and who would like to share that with kids. And so she said, we're going over to the pool to do our swimming lessons at Diamond Park. Do you know anybody who could explain the geothermal heating system to our kids? And so we looked at our database and I emailed a couple of them, and Alec Mezdak, who works at AALP, said he would love to. And so he did a little bit of research about how it works. He talked to her a little bit, and they talked a little bit about what a fourth grader's need, and then he did a 20-minute intro, took them behind the scenes at the pool, and they totally got it, meaning like the excitement, the content, the wow, this is how my pool works. That kind of excitement and understanding of the world around them in terms of what's hot underneath them here in Juno, as well as how does a pool get heated, those are one of the things we're really trying to encourage.
That sounds great. I would have loved that as a fourth grader, mm-hmm. the behind the scenes, you know. Wow, that sounds really cool. And let's see, Lindsay, you do a 2-3 class at the charter school, right?
Yes.
So what does this look like in the classroom for you? And I know other teachers around the district are doing STEM and...
Yeah, so in our classroom, what we focus on are doing some STEM challenges. And for our group, what we've really been working on is kind of the engineering process. And at its basic, what's developmentally appropriate for this group, we're talking about having a problem. Then the students come up with an idea, they create something, they test it, and then they figure out what they can improve on it. And so it's not just a one-and-done kind of thing. It's a revisiting of what we've done to make it better. And so the value of failure has really been an interesting idea in the classroom. There were a couple of students at the start of the year who dreaded the STEM challenges, and the kids were saying things like, well, there's no right answer. How am I going to do this if there's no right answer? And I don't know how to do this, and this is really hard. And there were a couple of times when we'd get together as a group and we'd talk about, you know, what does that mean to fail? Are we really failing, or are we learning from it, and what happens from there? And so I can think of one student in particular who has really grown to love the STEM challenges and gets really excited about the fact that you can be so creative, that you get to see it from your own viewpoint, you get to analyze it, come up with these own ideas. And then the other big focus that we have in our classroom is on collaboration and working with others. And again, with that, we've really talked a lot about how difficult that can be and what value that has for us to learn how to work as a group, how to really struggle with our ideas and how to compromise and how to see things from others' perspectives. And so we've really seen a lot of growth in the kids from the start of the year with these challenges.
And can you give us an example of one of the challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the really open-ended ones that we did that ended up being really successful, meaning that we dropped everything else and worked only on this for 3 hours straight, was that I gave the students popsicle sticks, binder clips, and clothespins, and asked them what they could create with, I think they had
15 large popsicle sticks and 20 small 10 binder clips and like 20 clothespins, and what could you create? And this was toward the start of the year, and the kids went wild. They just wanted to know what they could do. What can I create with this? How can I change it? What happens if I work with the person sitting next to me? You know, can I add my idea to theirs? Can I decorate this? Do I get to add art? What, you know, can we write about this? I want to add a story. We ended up incorporating math into it that day, which was not my intention, but the kids wanted to know, you know, can I add rubber bands? Can I add this? And so we started talking about, okay, well, what is the cost of that for your design? And so that would be a really open-ended example. You can also go really specific and gear it more towards what your students are interested in. And so in discussions about what's going on in our community, our class got really concerned about some of the homelessness issues that have come up, and they wanted to propose some of their own ideas for how to solve that. So one of the STEM challenges that we had around that time was, how do you use these materials to create a temporary shelter? And so that was something that was really specific that they enjoyed working on because it was meaningful to them.
Okay. Brenda, last time you were on the show, you were talking about finding these experts, like the gentleman with AELNP, I think mm-hmm. it was. Mm-hmm. I imagine you're still looking for people in the community who want to pair
absolutely,
with teachers and teach what they know.
Absolutely. If people could go to junostem.org, that's our website, and our email there, junostemcoalition@gmail.com, will be there as well. So that will hook you into emailing us and letting us know that you want to participate. We started, frankly, with one database, and it didn't work. It's an engineering process. It's very much we are learning by doing. We're like, okay, I think we need to redo it. So we did a little prototype, and now we're going to do a bigger, better one. As more teachers get excited, oh, wait, hey, here's another person to put in that list, and more people want to be in that list as well. We need it to be flexible and be able to be used.
And off the top of your head, what might be a few expertise areas that you're looking for?
Oh, we need architects, we need mathematicians, we need computer software people, we need any type of scientists, construction people. I mean, all of these people are working with math and science and technology and engineering. They're making things, they're solving problems. That's and I think particularly to the point, they're living in Juneau, right? And they're understanding what the issues are around us. So for instance, when I've asked some of the teachers about things that they're already doing, because this is not a new idea. Many teachers have been working on this already. We're just really trying to help more teachers do it and make it easier for teachers to make those connections, because they don't know everybody who's out there. But Henry Hopkins, for instance, is a science teacher at JDHS, and he's been working with the Alaska Native elders for years on having them come into his classroom and work with his students and help them understand Tlingit halibut hooks and how they're particularly designed to be a certain size to catch a particular size of fish, you know, so that those things are happening already. UAF comes into Thunder Mountain already and does Dem Bones. They deconstruct and rearticulate. This year they're doing killer whales, and some of the bones were not strong enough, and so they actually are using a 3D printer to recreate those bones that didn't make it through the process.
Sure. This sounds great.
It's totally cool stuff.
Well, I wish we had more time. I could keep talking. You're going to have to come back and see us
soon.
Okay,
we'll do a monthly thing.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Remind us where we can contact you again.
So junostem.org or junostemcoalition@gmail.com. That will reach me, Brenda Taylor, or Becca Souza at JEDC as our co-chair. Those would be great ways. And in terms of other people wanting to join, we also are trying to help high school students have little mini shadowing opportunities and in these STEM fields. Like, so if anybody be willing to have a kid come and shadow them for a day or two, that's on the website.
All right. Brenda Taylor, Lindsay Holbert, thank you both so much for coming on the show today. We have about 20 more seconds here. The weather is currently 43 degrees at the Juneau International Airport. And going into tonight, the forecast calls for showers, likely mainly after 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 34. The forecast for tomorrow calls for showers, highs near 42. Thank you for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon.